In fact, as we saw, most of the people he contacted while in the Soviet Union were, in fact, left cover or diplomatic cover U.S. intelligence agents.
And for some reason, this this young man who had defected from the military and, as Dave mentioned, made traitorous use of America's top secret technology, handed over to our arch Cold War rivals, came back to the United States after deciding not to, being, interestingly enough, helped to come back to the United States by Governor John Connally of Texas, something that will come up later on, and came back to the United States, and absolutely nobody cared, and nobody bothered to debrief him, program him, I suppose, or anything that you might want to call it, except for one man, a strange man named Spaz T. Rakin, supposedly from Traveler's Aid, I guess like the welcome wagon coming out to help the Oswalds, Lee Harvey Oswald and his new Soviet bride, Marina, back into the country. But in fact, Spaz T. Rakin was a member of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, a key member of the World Anti-Communist League. This is the only person who met this arch-traitor and spy when he came back.
A key element, we should say, of what is now the World Anti-Communist League and what was coalescing into the World Anti-Communist League at this point. A couple of references. The whole U2 tangle we went into in considerable detail in radio or in Guns of November program number one. And the situation of the World Anti-Communist League we looked at in Radio Free America shows 14 and 15. And in number 15, we examined the Kennedy assassination, both as being one of the goals of the member organizations that were coalescing over a period of a little more than a decade in a series of organizational conferences. But also was one of the factors which helped to unite the various component sections of the World Anti-Communist League into that organization which formally incorporated in 1967.
And the World Anti-Communist League is indeed important because, as we're going to be seeing later on, a lot of these people who we're going to be dealing with have some kind of relations, peripheral or otherwise, with the World Anti-Communist League, Ed Butler being a classic example, and we're going to be talking about him in some depth tonight.
In fact, something we will go into when we redo the Guns of November this fall, but elements of the organizations which later were to coalesce into WACL, such as the Latin American Anti-Communist Confederation, the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, were instrumental in creating the rumor that Lee Harvey Oswald was being run by the Russians. We took a look at the assassination of Stefan Bandera by Bogdan Stashinsky, a reputed Soviet agent, and this was being cited by elements connected with WACL as being part of the same, an assassination performed by the same group of assassins who had dispatched John Kennedy. Charles Kirsten, who was an affiliate of the WACL, was Mrs. Stashinsky's attorney at the, was Mrs. Bandera's attorney at the trial of Bogdan Stashinsky. We went into that in Radio Free America number 15. Of course, the Bandera people go all the way back to World War II. They're hooked up with people like Theodor Oberlander. Frank Wisner helped bring them into the country. Those same white Russian fascist connections and Galen connections were investigated by a law partner, Wesley Liebler, of Frank Wisner. But the very same painting of Oswald Red was being done by elements which in 1967 were to combine into the World Anti-Communist League.
Strangely enough, as in much the same circle of people that Dave has just talked about as being the ones that were painting Oswald as being a communist agent, again, the man comes back from the Soviet Union after having defected and sold out his country. The only person who meets him is somebody from the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. He gets to Dallas and settles down, and all of his friends are either people working in high levels in the aerospace industry, or they are white Russian, fierce anti-communists.
Or American Nazis.
Or American Nazis,
such as George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the Führer of the American Nazi Party, whose name and address were in Oswald's address book.
He must have been one chummy commie to have been had so many friends that were so politically unlike him. So we have Oswald doing this. Oswald is also spending a lot of time in New Orleans, which is going to lead us to our first reading in just a moment. One of the main things that Oswald is supposedly doing in New Orleans is running the Fair Play for Cuba Committee New Orleans chapter. Now, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee was, in fact, a small pro-Castro, pro-Cuba organization, not very politically powerful. The interesting thing, however, is that Lee Harvey Oswald was the only member of the so-called New Orleans chapter, and the folks at the actual Fair Play for Cuba committee basically knew nothing about Oswald and had nothing to do with him whatsoever. So, interestingly enough, Oswald was running the Fair Play for Cuba committee out of a small building that was part of the 544 Camp Street hookup. 544 Camp Street, a downtown New Orleans building that seemingly, except for Oswald, who was running a pro-Castro operation, supposedly out of it.
Of which he was the only member.
Of which
the
he was the only member. Strangely enough, the 544 Camp Street milieu was, other than that, was entirely full of strange organizations that seemed to be working with Bay of Pigs people, Bay of Pigs veterans, ferociously anti-communist ex-intelligence people, people like Guy Bannister, a former FBI man and private detective who was himself running an operation that utilized, that he himself had been involved with getting together armaments for the Bay of Pigs, among other things, and was running an operation in which he spent a lot of time hanging out with ferocious anti-Castro Cubans who spent a great deal of time at 544 Camp Street. And strangely enough, there was Lee Harvey Oswald in the same building, virtually next door. And
actually, what it was there were two entrances to
two
the
doors.
Same building, 531 Lafayette Place and 544 Camp Street. Supposedly two different addresses, but if you walked up the flight of stairs, you arrived at the same place. So we're being asked to believe here that a fellow who had defected to the Soviet Union, betraying top secret intelligence information of the Russians, was able to return to the United States, was not met by the CIA or FBI, but instead begins palling around with a bunch of doctrinaire fascists, aerospace industry high rollers, and veteran U.S. intelligencers, was able to associate, although an alleged pro-Castro communist, was able to freely associate not only with the CIA, whose number 110669 he was, but also with the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the CIA's anti-Castro group, which just happened to be occupying the same address as Lee Harvey Oswald, the total membership of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee of New Orleans.
That's right. So bear in mind what we have here. This is in the spring and summer of 1963, shortly before the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Lee Harvey Oswald is splitting his time between Dallas, where Marina lives and where all of his aerospace industry and white Russian friends are, and New Orleans, where he is running around running the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, again, of which he is the sole member, and where he just happens to be hanging out in the same building with major anti-Castro operations, CIA operatives, ex-FBI men, gun runners, et cetera, et cetera. Now, again, our first segment we're going to read here is from the book Conspiracy by Anthony Summers, copyright 1980 by McGraw-Hill, and
a couple of the other denizens of 544 Camp Street, because you may hear quick references to them in this particular passage. One was a fellow named David Ferry, who was a former CIA pilot who'd worked first with Fidel Castro when Castro was receiving CIA support in his wars against Batista, then worked against Fidel Castro. He also was a chum of Carlos Marcello, capo mafioso for New Orleans. He was an investigator in Guy Bannister's detective office, about which you'll find that Guy Bannister's detective office was a lot more than just a detective office. He also was not only a long-standing associate of Lee Harvey Oswald's, going back to Oswald's days in the Civil Air Patrol. He also was cited by the House Select Committee on Assassinations as the main focus, as the place to begin an investigation, which they recommended to the Justice Department. Also, incidentally, the major focus of Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans as well.
And another person being referred to in this article will be, they'll be calling her Mrs. Roberts. This is Delphine Roberts, the lady friend of Guy Bannister herself, an extremist right-wing political figure, and somebody who, one of the people who has actually said, after the fact, that in fact Lee Harvey Oswald came to Guy Bannister for a job, and the two of them had a long closed door interview in his office, and when he came out, they appeared to have reached an understanding. Remember, again, this is Guy Bannister, who is one of the Bay of Pigs armaments people, and a right-wing former FBI man, and Lee Harvey Oswald, the traitorist communist.
The CIA, who was working for the CIA, just like Guy Bannister, as we're about to see.
That's right. Again, reading from Conspiracy. Bannister's brother told the Assassinations Committee that Guy, quote, mentioned seeing Oswald hand out Fair Play for Cuba literature, unquote. Ivan Nitschke, a business associate of Bannister and a fellow former FBI agent, recalls that Bannister, quote, became interested in Oswald, unquote, in the summer of 1963. Adrian Alba, who ran the garage next door to Oswald's place of work, testified to the committee that he often saw Oswald in the restaurant on the ground floor of 544 Camp Street. That restaurant, excuse me, had a rear exit leading up to the office section of the building, and Bannister was a regular patron. Mrs. Roberts firmly believes that whatever the nature of Bannister's, quote, interest in Oswald, it concerned anti-Castro schemes, plans, which she feels certain had the support and encouragement of government intelligence agencies. As she puts it, quote, Mr. Bannister had been a special agent for the FBI and was still working for them. There were quite a number of connections which he kept with the FBI and the CIA, too. I know he and the FBI traded information due to his former association, unquote. Bannister's former employee, Daniel Campbell, also became convinced that his boss was involved with the FBI. An FBI report of an interview with Bannister after the assassination, that's of course the assassination of John F. Kennedy, indicates that he was asked questions about anti-Castro exiles, but none at all about Oswald, or use of the 544 Camp Street address on Oswald's leaflets. As for Bannister and the CIA, an assassinations committee check revealed only that the agency, quote, considered using Guy Bannister Associates for the collection of foreign intelligence, unquote, but decided against it. That, however, was in 1960, 3 years before the episode of Oswald in New Orleans. Delphine Roberts says, quote, I think he received funds from the CIA. I know he had access to large funds at various times in 1963. She adds that known intelligence agents and law enforcement officers frequently visited Bannister's office. 16 years ago, she accepted the comings and goings as quite normal, because so far as she was concerned, the strangers were involved with her boss in, quote, doing something to try to stop what was taking place, the danger that was facing this country because of Cuba, unquote. The anti-Castro exiles involved with Bannister make an intriguing list. There was Sergio Arcacha Smith, an extreme right-winger who had served under Castro's predecessor, the dictator Batista. In 1961, he became New Orleans representative of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, CRC, and, at Bannister's instigation, set up the CRC office at 544 Camp Street.
That last sentence might be worth repeating here because, again, this connection here is going to bear directly on Ed Butler and the Information Council of the Americas, and Ed Butler's a thread which is going to connect these seemingly distant events of 1963 with the depredations of the Manson family, not only an apparent Nazi and U.S. intelligence operation, but for the purposes of the Satanist theme of this archive series, an offshoot of the process umbrella cult, both a Nazi and a Satanist organization.
I'm going to read that again then. Sergio Arcacha Smith, who in 1961 became New Orleans representative of the Cuban Revolutionary Council and, at Bannister's instigation, set up the CRC office at 544 Camp Street. CIA records reveal that Arcacha, quote, maintained extensive relations with the FBI. Two of his regular FBI contacts were name deleted and Guy Bannister. Significantly, Bannister, supposedly long retired, is referred to flatly as an active FBI contact. Arcacha, who said privately he was controlled by the CIA, turned 544 Camp Street, in the words of one of his acquaintances, into a sort of, quote, Cuban Grand Central Station for the exiles. When Arcacha cast around for funds, he was offered a, quote, substantial donation by none other than Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans mafia boss. By 1963, Arcacha had moved to Texas, removed from his New Orleans CRC job after accusations of misappropriation of funds. Arcacha denies all knowledge of Oswald prior to the assassination, but one of his successors did encounter the alleged assassin. This was CRC delegate Frank Bartes, or Bartes, B-A-R-T-E-S, who turned up with Carlos Bringier for the court case following the street fracas. We're going to talk about that in a moment. On that occasion, he indulged in a noisy argument with Oswald. Okay, so one of the key people, Sergio Arcacha Smith, we mentioned, and Carlos Bringier. And Carlos Bringier, we're actually going to be hearing in just a little while.
Now, again, the relationship here between the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, headed up by Lee Harvey Oswald, the only member at that time, and the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the unlikeliness of these two organizations sharing the same address, among the people, by the way, who was also blowing in and out of the same place, who worked as an investigator for Bannister, was Maurice Brooks Gatlin, who was a key planner at many of the planning conferences which were involved in setting up the World Anti-Communist League, of which we spoke earlier. Now, the interrelationship between the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and the Cuban Revolutionary Council and 544 Camp Street, recall these two highly unlikely organizations are sharing the same address, an extremely remote possibility under the circumstances. And in turn, the relationship between Carlos Bringier, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the Information Council of the Americas, military intelligence, and Ed Butler, because Ed Butler is a fellow who's going to draw together a lot of themes. What we're basically looking at here is a U.S. intelligence disinformation milieu, one that will operate in the Robert Kennedy assassination, one that will operate in the John Kennedy assassination, as we're looking at, one which will figure in the disinformation storm surrounding the Manson family provocations in 1969, and one which also involves the political milieu behind Ronald Reagan as well. Now, returning once again to Anthony Summers' conspiracy, Carlos Bringier, the exile in the New Orleans clash with Oswald, certainly had direct contact with the CIA. He was New Orleans delegate of the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, the outgrowth of a militant Cuban student group. The group had naturally been deeply involved with the CIA at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion and continued to receive funds afterward. The Assassinations Committee found that Bringier had reported his contact with Oswald to his group's headquarters in Miami and that the information had in turn been relayed to the CIA. A document obtained from the agency reveals that the CIA had, quote, passed contact with Carlos Bringier. Contact was limited to domestic service activities, unquote. As we noted in the case of George de Morenschild's CIA contacts, the Domestic Contacts Division is best known for its efforts to obtain information from travelers returning from communist countries. However, CIA spokesmen have in the past confused inquirers by using that title rather than Domestic Operations Division, the clandestine department which by 1963 was conducting secret operations within the United States. Carlos Bringier, as New Orleans head of the DRE, also published a right-wing news sheet backed by the Crusade to Free Cuba Committee. That committee was founded by the CIA. It turns out that the agency's fingerprints mark every stage of the process by which Oswald was exposed as a communist. Let me repeat that last sentence again. It turns out that the agency's fingerprints mark every stage of the process by which Oswald was exposed as a communist. Very little about that, it seems, was spontaneous. First, Carlos Bringier, by the way, B-R-I-N-G-U-I-E-R is how his last name is spelled, called William Stuckey, S-T-U-C-K-E-Y, a young reporter who had a weekly radio show on station WDSU. Stuckey went to see Oswald and found him a clean-cut, articulate figure, quite the opposite of the unkempt, wild-looking, left-wing prototype he had anticipated. After recording and broadcasting the initial interview, one which he would later recall as oddly deliberate, unquote, Stuckey then began planning a follow-up debate program. What ensued was a classic case of media manipulation for political profit. Stuckey found himself positively showered with information guaranteed to smear Oswald. First, there was a telephone conversation with either the head or the deputy head of the local FBI office, who obligingly read out large extracts from Oswald's file. Thus did Stuckey learn of Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union. Soon, the industrious Bringier popped up again, eager to impress similar information on the reporter. He said he had obtained it by sending an anti-Castro colleague to see Oswald, posing as a Castro sympathizer. Finally, the same day, Stuckey received a phone call from Edward Butler, director of a right-wing propaganda organization called the Information Council of the Americas, or INCA. Butler confided that after telephone calls to Washington, he had confirmed Oswald's Soviet connections with, quote, someone at the House Un-American Activities Committee, unquote. The very title, Information Council of the Americas, unquote, speaks volumes for its origins and allegiances. At the time of the Oswald revelations, its manager was a member of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the anti-Castro government in exile created by the CIA. And I would add, but although Anthony Summers doesn't have it in this passage, he had it in the previous passage, the same organization which under Sergio Arcacha Smith and the obliging Guy Bannister had set up shopkeeping at 544 Camp Street, the other walk-up address to entrance to 531 Lafayette Place, which was housing Lee Harvey Oswald's ostensible pro Castro activities. Now, Ed Butler is the key name here in the intersection between the CRC, 544 Camp Street, and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee is to be noted.
Now, as they mentioned, every single step of the way, people are fighting to have Lee Harvey Oswald identified as being a communist. Now, bear in mind, this is a man who apparently was of no interest to anybody when he came back from the Soviet Union, has a tiny little supposedly progressive political organization or left-wing political organization of which he is the only member, and yet people are calling up night and day, calling Washington. The FBI is reading his files out over the phone. Carlos Bringier, who himself is a top kicker in a large anti-Castro organization, is putting a lot of time into this guy who has no members and no sway and no clout whatsoever.
Well, beyond that, this is a guy who is pro-Castro, who's able to move in the same milieu with the anti-Castro Cubans, and the recent revelations under the Iran-Contra scandal focused once again the spotlight of public scrutiny on the venality and the bloody history of the anti-Castro Cubans.
Absolutely.
So we're now going to listen to a tape of the interview with Lee Harvey Oswald, Ed Butler of the Information Council of the Americas, headed up by a member of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, which again is set up shop at 544 Camp Street, along with Lee Harvey Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee. You could call this the Red Bucket Brigade. We're now going to listen to a tape of the second of those interviews on radio station WDSU in New Orleans.
Tonight, Bill Stuckey and I are talking with three guests, Lee Harvey Oswald, who is local secretary of a group called Fair Play for Cuba, and with Ed Butler, the executive director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Bringier, a Cuban refugee and obviously anti-Castro. Mr. Oswald, as you might imagine, is on the hot seat tonight, and I believe, Bill Stuckey, you have a question for him.
Yes, Mr. Oswald, I believe you said in reply to a question from Mr. Butler that any questions about your background were extraneous to the discussion tonight. I disagree, because of the fact that you refuse to reveal any of the other members of your organization, so you are the face of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans. Therefore, anybody who might be interested in this organization ought to know more about you. For this reason, I'm curious to know just how you supported yourself during the 3 years that you lived in the Soviet Union. Did you have a government subsidy?
I will answer that question directly then, you will not rest until you get your answer. I worked in Russia. I was under the protection of I was not under the protection of the American government, but that is, I was at all times considered an American citizen. I did not lose my American citizenship.
Did you say you wanted to at one point, though, or what happened?
Well, it's a long drawn out situation in which permission to live in the Soviet Union granted to a foreign resident is very rarely given. This requires a certain amount of technicalities, technical papers and so forth. At no time, as I say, did I renounce my citizenship or attempt to renounce my citizenship, and at no time was I out of contact or with the American embassy.
May I interrupt just one second? Either one of these two statements is wrong. The Washington Evening Star of October 31st, 1959, page 1, reported that Lee Harvey Oswald, a former Marine of 4936 Collingwood Street, Fort Worth, Texas, had turned in his passport at the American Embassy in Moscow on that same date and had said that he had applied for Soviet citizenship. Now, this seems to me that you've renounced your American citizenship if you've turned in your passport.
Well, the very obvious answer to that is that I'm back in the United States. A person who renounces his citizenship becomes legally disqualified for returning to the United States.
Right, and Soviet authorities, this is from the Washington Post and Times Herald of November 16, 1959, Soviet authorities had refused to grant it, although they had informed him that he could live in Russia as a resident alien. What did you do during the 2 weeks from October 31st to November 16th, 1959?
As I've already stated, of course, this is a whole conversation, and we don't have too much time left, is getting away from the Cuban-American problem. However, I'm quite willing to discuss myself for the remainder of this program. As I have stated, it is very difficult for a resident, for a foreigner to get permission to reside in the Soviet Union. During those 2 weeks and during the date that you mentioned, I was, of course, with the knowledge of the American embassy, getting this permission.
Were you having a building at 11 Kuznetskaya Street in Moscow?
Kuznetskaya?
Mm-hmm.
Kuznetskaya is the, that would be probably the foreign ministry, I assume. No, I was never in that place, although I know Moscow, having lived there.
Mr. Butler, let me interrupt, and I think Mr. Oswald is right. To this extent, we should get around to the organization which he is the head of here in New Orleans, Fair Play for Cuba.
Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
As a practical matter, Mr. Oswald, knowing, as you, I'm sure you do, the sentiment in America against Cuba, we, of course, severed diplomatic relations some time ago. I would say Castro is about as unpopular as anybody in the world in this country. As a practical matter, what do you hope to gain through your work? How do you hope to bring about what you call fair play for Cuba, knowing the sentiment?
The principles of the fair play for Cuba consist of restoration of diplomatic trade and tourist relations with Cuba. That is one of our main points. We are for that. I disagree that this situation regarding American-Cuban relations is very unpopular. We are in a minority, surely. We are, however, not particularly interested in what Cuban exiles or rightist members of rightist organizations have to say. We are primarily interested in the attitude of the United States government toward Cuba. And in that way, we are striving to get the United States to adopt measures which would be more friendly toward the Cuban people and the new Cuban regime in that country. We are not at all communist controlled, regardless of the fact that I have the experience of living in Russia, regardless of the fact that we have been investigated, regardless of any of those facts. The Fair Play for Cuba Committee is an independent organization, not affiliated with any other organization. Our aims and our ideals are very clear and in the best keeping with American traditions of democracy.
Do you agree with Fidel Castro when he, in his last speech of July 26 of this year, he qualified President John Fitzgerald Kennedy of the United States as a ruffian and a thief? Do you agree with Mr. Castro?
I would not agree with that particular wording. However, I and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee does think that the United States government, through certain agencies, namely the State Department and the CIA, has made monumental mistakes in its relations with Cuba, mistakes which are pushing Cuba into the sphere of activity of, let's say, a very dogmatic communist country as China is.
Mr. Oswald, would you agree that when Castro first took power, would you agree that the United States was very friendly with Castro, that the people of this country had nothing but admiration for him, that they were very glad to see Batista thrown out?
I would say that the activities of the United States government in regard to Batista were a manifestation of not so much support for Fidel Castro, but rather a withdrawal of support from Batista. In other words, we stopped armaments to Batista. What we should have done was to take those armaments and drop them into the Sierra Maestre, where Fidel Castro could have used them. As for public sentiment at that time, I think even at that time, even before the revolution, there were rumblings of official comment and so forth from government officials against Fidel Castro.
You've never been to Cuba, of course, but why are the people in Cuba starving today?
Well, in any country emerging from a semi-colonial state and embarking upon reforms which require a diversification of agriculture, you're going to have shortages. After all, 80% of imports into the United States from Cuba were two products, tobacco and sugar. Nowadays, while Cuba is reducing its product as far as sugarcane goes, it is striving to grow unlimited and unheard of for Cuba quantities of certain vegetables, sweet potatoes, lima beans, cotton, and so forth, so that they can become agriculturally independent.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to interrupt. Our time is almost up. We've had three guests tonight on Conversation Carte Blanche. Bill Stuckey and I have been talking with Lee Harvey Oswald, Secretary of the New Orleans Chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, Ed Butler, Executive Director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Bringier, a Cuban refugee. Thank you very much, and good evening.
Good evening indeed. Now stay tuned here. That concludes the brief interview, staged, and we use the word staged advisedly, on radio station WDSU in New Orleans. in 1963, 25 years ago. We're now going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to...
Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills, back with more information in just a second. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond / Radio Free America, examining this evening the impact of the assassination of President Kennedy upon American history. Obviously, the significance of Kennedy's diplomatic initiatives towards Castro, the rather obvious intervention on behalf of CIA and other elements of the national security establishment in order to make the assassination appear to be a Cuban-inspired plot, well, the impact that those events had could scarcely be measured today. It is difficult to gauge exactly how different our policy towards Latin America might be if the United States had developed the capacity to distinguish between democratic socialist countries that are arising in that part of the world as a response to the often U.S.-inspired and all-pervasive tyranny in that part of the world, if we had developed the capacity to distinguish between nations of that type and revolutions of that type and, quote, Soviet puppets, unquote. Well, again, it's difficult to imagine where we might be today. We're going to take a look now at the third program in a four-part series done in November of 1983 upon the 20th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination called The Guns of November. The Guns of November number 3 deals, first of all, with President Kennedy's attempts to pull the United States out of Vietnam. Even today, at a distance of some 13 years from the fall of Saigon, this country continues to wrestle with its Vietnam experience. Movies, popular movies about the war, be it Rambo or Chuck Norris missing in action, things of that kind. The television shows, which in which so many of the characters are always Vietnam veterans and they have the flashbacks. The nostalgic documentaries one sees about the 60s and the protests and things of that kind. The United States continues to wrestle with its Vietnam experience. And this evening we're going to take a look at just how intimately involved the Kennedy assassination is with the course of America's Vietnam involvement. The simple fact of the matter is that one of the reasons President Kennedy was killed is that he was pulling the United States out of Vietnam. And again, next week and the week after that, more information on the Kennedy assassination will be covered, including some of the physical evidence. I didn't think that was the thing to go into this evening. I think with the 25th anniversary of the assassination just 2 days away, it was more important this evening to take a look at why this is such an important event, why it should not be allowed to lapse into historical forgetfulness, I guess one could say, or historical ignorance. Most people simply don't know what happened. And yet, such a huge and tragic event as the Vietnam War is so central to the story of the assassination of President Kennedy. This is something, unfortunately, which most Americans simply don't realize. Right now, we're going to go into the Guns of November Part 3, Vietnam and Watergate. After the discussion of Kennedy's attempts to pull the United States out of Vietnam, you're going to hear about how intimately involved intertwined, the Kennedy assassination is with the Watergate scandal, which helped set much of the tone, much of the cynical tone that one sees today. This is Guns of November number 3, first a discussion of the Kennedy assassination and the Vietnam War.
Now, we're going to be talking about the Kennedy assassination of the Vietnam War, and we're going to be presenting a view of history which is going to contrast rather sharply with the views both on the Kennedy assassination and on the Vietnam War. Generally speaking, conventional history has it that there was a continuity of policy from Kennedy to Lyndon Johnson with regard to just about all things, including and particularly the Vietnam War, rather, and that is not the case. Now, we're going to be dealing with an essay here called The Kennedy Assassination and the Vietnam War. Now, that is an excerpt from a book called The War Conspiracy, authored by a University of California at Berkeley professor named Peter Dale Scott. Those of you who were tuned in last week may remember Ted Rubenstein, a fine researcher who works with us here on the station, and his discussions of Peter Dale Scott's work. Well, Peter, as I said, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, has done some excellent research about the Pentagon Papers and about the relationship between the Pentagon Papers and the memoranda from which they were drawn up. In just a second, Nip Tuck's going to read you an introduction here from Peter Dale Scott's essay Be informed that the book from which this section is excerpted was suppressed, basically. It was called The War Conspiracy by Bobs Merrill. Supposed to have come out in 72. It basically really never came out. It was suppressed, and part of the reason why you're going to see in just a couple of minutes. Before Niptuck gets into the editor's introduction, and by the way, the essay here is going to come from a book called The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond. That's an excellent anthology about the Kennedy and other assassinations. The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond is published in soft cover by the Vintage Press, copyrighted 1976, and edited by Peter Dale Scott, the author of The Kennedy Assassination and the Vietnam War, Paul L. Hock, and Russell Stettler. Hock, H-O-C-H, Stettler, S-T-E-T-L-E-R. Now, this is going to be a very, very complicated discussion that we're going to be getting into, not to try and intimidate you, but you're going to be hearing discussion of some National Security Action Memoranda, and even before Niptuck gets into the introduction here, I'm going to try and lay out the basic numbers here for you so that you can locate yourself in Nip's introduction and in the weighty tape segments that are going to follow here. National Security Action Memoranda. Prefix these NSAM. NSAM standing for National Security Action Memorandum. Okay, we're going to have four National Security Action Memoranda here to keep in mind. Okay, so jot these down. First of all, NSAM 111. NSAM 111, that's dated November 22nd, 1961, 2 years to the day before Kennedy is assassinated. Okay, NSAM 111, 11-22-61. Second memorandum, NSAM 249, NSAM 249, that's dated June 25th of 1963. Okay, the third memorandum is NSAM 263. NSAM 263, and that is dated October 11th, 1963, 10-11-63. And there are two other dates that we're going to talk about that and in connection with that. And the fourth memorandum is NSAM 273, NSAM 273. And there appears to be a little bit of a conflict on the date. NSAM 273 was formally issued on 11-26-63. But it was put together at a meeting of the National Security Council on November 24th, 1963. That was 2 days after Kennedy was killed, and it was the evening of the morning on which Ruby executed Oswald, okay? So four memoranda. 111 from 11-22-61, 249 from 6-25-63, 263 from 10-11-63, and 273 from 11-26-63. Now here's what they did. NSAM 111 committed the United States to helping the South Vietnamese, and it pointedly avoided, Kennedy in this memorandum, pointedly avoided committing us to helping the South Vietnamese win. Now, this is more than a semantic distinction, a trifling semantic distinction here. There's the difference between committing us to helping the South Vietnamese and helping the South Vietnamese to win, basically, was the difference between a limited and diplomatic approach to the seeking a limited and diplomatic commitment, a limited commitment with a diplomatic solution to the Vietnam War, and an open-ended commitment and a military solution. Two basic and sharply contrasting ways of dealing with the Vietnam situation. Kennedy avoided ever committing us to helping the South Vietnamese win, and there was a long, complicated battle within his administration over these words, symbolized by commitment to the objective, much more than just a semantic trifle, as I mentioned here, because it really was the difference between a diplomatic solution and a military solution. Okay, NSAM 249 from June 25th of 1963. That was Kennedy's last official document dealing with covert action against North Vietnam, and it pointedly withheld, it suspended all covert action against North Vietnam pending a review of policy. And that was the last official Kennedy document on the subject. And the significance of this, of course, is that it was covert action against North Vietnam, which was to result in the Gulf of Tonkin incident and our eventual involvement in the war. National Security Action Memorandum 263. Now, that basically provided for a phased withdrawal program from Vietnam intended not only to help get our troops out, but also to force then South Vietnamese President Diem to the conference table. NSAM 263 provided for a phased withdrawal of troops from between 1,000 and 1,500 troops, and that was, as I said, October 11th, 1963. Now, NSAM 273, put together 2 days after Kennedy was killed and issued 4 days after his death, that canceled basically all of the previous three memoranda. It committed us to helping the South Vietnamese win as opposed to helping the South Vietnamese, thereby canceling, in effect, NSAM 111. It basically provided for covert action against North Vietnam, whereas Kennedy had suspended it, thereby negating the effect of Kennedy's NSAM 249. It canceled the troop withdrawal and committed us to aid levels at least as high as in the Diem regime, and gave indications that we should explore other means of pursuing the war and carrying it north, thereby negating NSAM 263. So keep those in mind. We're going to talk some more about them before we get into the tape here, but it's very complicated, and you really got to have those four memoranda down in order to locate yourself in the maelstrom that's going to follow here.
I think you just did the intro for me. One other thing to mention, and this is crucially important because of this is essentially the thesis of what we're talking about here. If Mr. Scott's research proves as accurate as it seems to, that what we are essentially talking about is not only the false story, but we're looking at the very real possibility that if John F. Kennedy had not been assassinated, we would not have the Vietnam War hanging on the American consciousness the way it has, for a variety of reasons. And it's very possible the Vietnam War would have been over by 1964. Would have made quite a difference in the American body politic.
One small point that I forgot to mention, the Pentagon Papers themselves, what they were, the Pentagon Papers were a history of the Vietnam War put together by the Pentagon, and they were put together at the request of then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara under President Johnson, and they were compiled from the various memoranda, including the four talked about above. And these were the Pentagon Papers, okay? So because that's essentially what Peter Dale Scott's going to be talking about here. And we'll talk about the Pentagon Papers and their relationship to Watergate in the second half of the broadcast.
All right. Now, this is reading again from Peter Dale Scott's essay, The Kennedy Assassination of the Vietnam War. This is from the book, The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond. And this was written in 1972 by Mr. Scott. It was the received wisdom of American commentators in the first months of Lyndon Johnson's presidency that the assassination of President Kennedy would have little impact on U.S. policies, domestic or foreign. President Johnson's first speech to Congress on November 27, 1963, quote, "Let us continue," and his retention of Kennedy's top advisors both served to underline this appearance of continuity. In retrospect, it has become clear that in at least one area of U.S. policy planning, Vietnam, this appearance was illusory. On November 20, 1963, the Kennedy administration had publicly announced plans to withdraw between 1,000 and 1,300 troops from Vietnam by the year's end. The Johnson administration not only quietly canceled these plans, but also replaced them with high-level planning for covert escalation and expansion of the war into North Vietnam. One of the Pentagon Papers, published in 1971, attributes this abrupt reversal of direction to a perception, new in December of 1963, of how close the Saigon regime was to collapse. Peter Dale Scott, in his researches into the Pentagon Papers, has reached a different and more disturbing conclusion. Scott argues that the reversal was in fact authorized by a secret National Security Action Memorandum, NSAM 273, at an unofficial emergency meeting on November 24, 1963, only 2 days after President Kennedy's assassination.